today is going to be the day that they're going to throw it back to you. It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 67 of the SAFTAcast. Before we get to talking about today's episode, I just want to backtrack for a second. Tell you a little bit about episode 66 for a second. Hey, what'd you guys think back in December when we released that episode talking about a movie, Santa with Muscles Roundtable? We've been having some discussions here at the old podcast about that, and we want to know what you think. Should we do another one like that, maybe in the springtime here, or maybe in early summer? Maybe get a couple other writers on, or whatever, and talk about another film? Should we do a good film? Should we do a bad film? Should we discuss a book? Should we discuss something else that, of course, is not related to writing, but some other form of media? We really want to hear from you about this. Drop us a line on the SAFTAcast Facebook page, on Twitter at SAFTAcast, or you can always hunt me out on Facebook if you really want, and we can talk about it. I've got more to talk about, and I want to drop it to you right now, because coming up in just about a week and a half, about 2 weeks maybe thereabouts, is the annual Writers and Writing Programs Convention, the AWP Convention, this year in Washington, D.C., and of course, Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts will be in attendance in D.C. when the convention goes down at the book fair. You will find us. Lots of events being planned, then off-site reading, multiple book signings from different authors at the table the whole time of the convention, book titles aplenty for sale, as well as information about the Sundress Academy, all of our various programs, such as Outspoken, the Sundress Reading Series, Poets in Pajamas, all of our various things. For information on all of the events, the schedule of writers, and everything that's going to happen, I advise you, my friends, keep a close eye on the Sundress Publications and Sundress Academy for the Arts social media. You can find them on Twitter at Sundress Pub. You can also find Sundress Publications on Facebook by searching out Sundress Publications there. You can also find the Sundress Academy for the Arts Facebook page there. I encourage you again, keep a watch on these social media places because we will be announcing all of our lineups, schedule of events, and much, much more, all of our details, as well as, I'm sure, photos and thoughts from the convention floor, all there during the week as it happens. And guess what? The SAFTAcast will be there, at least in spirit. Once again, folks, we are going to be there at AWP. Unfortunately, I will not be there live, but the podcast will be doing another giveaway. Now, if you recall, last year we did a little giveaway we called the Mugshot Giveaway, where if you took a photo of yourself with the Sundress SAFTAcast coffee mug, the official one, at the table, you could enter a contest to win that mug. Well, we're doing something similar this year, but a slight twist on it. Here it is, ladies and gentlemen, the announcement. The SAFTAcast 2017 AWP Mugshot Giveaway. Three easy steps. One, take a photo of a cup of coffee. Any cup. Anywhere in D.C. during the convention. Two, tweet it to us at SAFTAcast or post it on Facebook and make sure you tag us in it. And then three, congrats, you are entered to win an official SAFTAcast coffee mug, as well as maybe some other stuff from us at Sundress Pub. We might put a nice little prize pack together to you. But again, very easy rules on that one. We will put them up on the SAFTAcast.com website, and you can find them there. Now let's talk about episode 67 at last here. We are today's guest, Bernard Grant. Truly excellent writer, excellent person to chat with, and he is an excellent lover of cats. And that's something that we talk about quite a bit on today's program because recently the SAFTA Cat, if you've been following us on our social media, know that the SAFTAcast has its own little mascot, our SAFTA Cat, was recently joined by a small black kitten. So we spend some time talking about that, but it is not just cat fever that Bernard and I have. We also have a fever for teaching, and in this episode we talk about our first times up in the classroom long ago and not so long ago, as well as discuss whether writing can be considered a life skill. And we also discuss why you should burn and destroy your old journals. That's all coming at you in just about 31 seconds from now. Bernard.
Yeah. Oh, hi. So, the first time I used Skype was maybe a week ago, and during the middle of it, the audio just stopped working.
Well, we'll hope for the best then. And
doing it on the computer, hoping it doesn't mess up.
We'll hope for the best, but it is great to have you on the show here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Sorry about the little delay here. We just got a second cat in our house, and she's been using the office here as a little home base before getting integrated with the other cat.
Oh, how do you integrate? I have a cat, but I want another cat, but I'm worried that my cat won't like that cat because she doesn't seem like other animals.
How old is your cat?
She's about 3 years old.
And we have a 5-year old. For us, we wanted a younger cat, but not too young. We ended up with a 5-month old.
Oh.
So it's kind of the equivalent of a 40-year-old person suddenly waking up to find a 4-year-old as their roommate.
Are they getting along?
They're starting to. We kept them apart for about a week. And during that time did small things like we would pet one of the cats with a clean gym sock and then let the other cat play with it. So they get the scent and go, okay, well, that's a familiar scent. And
Yeah, there's not much controlling cats from my experience.
How long have you had a cat?
I was talking to someone about this yesterday. It was like February 2015, so it would be almost 2 years now, right? Yep.
Did you adopt it from a shelter, or was it a friend that was like, hey, can you take my cat?
Oh, no, I adopted it from a shelter. I wanted a cat. I just finally moved into a place where I could have a cat, and I had a cat. I moved to my first apartment, and I ended up with 3 cats. So for a long time, I just didn't have one, and I really wanted a cat. And so now I have one, and I want another one, but all the other cats we lived with, she just doesn't seem to like them.
You have a female?
Yeah. Her name's Marissa.
Aw. Short hair, long hair?
Medium hair, but sometimes she's very, very fluffy, and she sheds all over the place. Yeah, they said she's a medium-haired domestic.
Yeah, whatever that means.
Yeah, I don't know. But she's very. I got her from a shelter, and she's very nervous, very scared all the time. If I stand up, she often takes off running, and like, well, you know, we've been living together for like a year and a half. Almost 2 years. I don't see why you're so afraid of me. But I don't know what happened to her before I found her.
Was it love at first sight kind of thing at the shelter?
One sided for me. I was like, oh, that's my cat. I gotta have that one. There's 5 other ones, and I just love this one, Marissa. She's all black, but no, she was terrified for a long time. she didn't want to go home with me. She in the car, she cried the whole time, and then she hid my closet and under my bed for maybe 4 or 5 days before she came out.
I've heard cats choose their owners, though.
Oh, what does that mean?
When you go to the shelter, the cat, like, some cat will, like, nuzzle it. I'll take an example. Our first cat is named Hef. He's a 5-year-old tuxedo. I found him in a shelter, and he started playing with my shoelaces and nuzzling my leg. And I'm like, okay, you're coming home with me.
Oh, I guess I was just looking for the fluffiest cat. I mean, like, really, really furry thing.
Nothing wrong with that. Floofy cats are awesome.
Yeah. You say floofy?
Yeah.
Oh, floofy. I say fluffy. I call them fluffy faces.
Aw. You mentioned you lived with 3 cats previously. Did you own cats as like a child, or were you more of a dog person, or just no pets?
No. My mom was allergic to cats, and she was always afraid of animals. So when I was somewhere between 10 and 12, my childhood is kind of cloudy in my memory. My grandfather's dog gave birth to a litter of puppies, so me and my brother wanted one, and so we got two puppies, but there's like this feud with the neighbors, and then my mom had, she didn't get along with the neighbors, and the neighbors said that our dog bit her dog, which wasn't true, but we got rid of them anyway. So we got rid of those puppies, and then I just didn't have any pets until I moved out. And I first moved out of her house into a friend's house. He had a couple of cats, and he had a snake and two birds and a ferret and a couple of dogs. So I lived there for a month with his family and all those animals, and I just kind of got obsessed with cats. So ended up with a calico. When I moved out of his house, my brother and I, to our own apartment, we ended up with a calico and two little black cats.
It's like a whole menagerie there. Cats, snake, ferret, dogs, birds.
Yeah. And then there was me and my brother living there, and then my friend's brother, and then his girlfriend sometimes stay over here. And then there was also, a stepfather, and then another friend who would occasionally sleep over. So it was just like a three-bedroom house, one story, but there was just a lot going on.
Sounds like a big, full house, you know.
Impressive. Yeah, but it was a story.
Were those three cats that you lived with, the calico and the two blacks, were they also shelter cats?
No, the calico was, we had this friend who, she was I lived in San Antonio, and we would often travel to Austin, between Austin and San Antonio, if Austin just had this sort of, I guess, I don't know, exciting life that we wanted a part of. So a lot of our friends would go to Austin for shows and for music and things like that. So one friend, on the way from Austin one night, she found a calico. She's a tiny baby kitten at a rest stop. And the first thing she did was bring her to my apartment. And we just begged her to let us keep her. She wanted to name the cat Kitty, which I thought was stupid. It was like I don't know, I think it was supposed to be some kind of like elegant version of Kitty. But she was a lush, and she was very drunk at the time. And eventually we just named her Clementine because we had a box of Clementines.
That's a great name. Pet owning name is kind of weird in a way. Like, I understand wanting to name it something normal, but there's a part of me that just wanted to name our cat something ridiculous, like Walter Cronkite.
but I guess you end up calling it Walter when you call the cat. Like, right? Because you wouldn't say the whole thing. Like, come here, Walter Cronkite.
We had a long-standing one. When my partner and I were dating very early on, I did have this dream, and I told her about it. I said, I have a dream that one day we're going to own a cat named Lavender O'Washtub.
Why is that?
I have no idea. Just the name came to me, and so... But we decided that the new cat's name is going to be Hikari, which is the Japanese word for light, because she's completely jet black, and she is so tiny that you can lift her with no problem. So she's so light physically.
Oh, and that's the new cat you have?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And so is it a furry cat, or what kind of cat is it?
Just a black domestic short hair, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my domestic medium hair, all black. People say she's big. She doesn't seem big to me, but I hear that she's big.
I felt that, like, about the other cat we have, who's five. I'm like, I didn't realize how big he was until he was up against a kitten. But he's not.
Yeah, my cat is, like, 13, 14 pounds up, and people say she's big. The other day, someone came over to my apartment and said she's long. And the people, like, and I'll point her out in the window, like, if I'm outside to someone, we say, oh, she's a big cat. Okay, but then I see other people's cats, and I guess she is kind of big. And she's not really easy to pick up with one hand.
I'm waiting for the day. I don't know what she's going to turn into. She might be a monster, like, in terms of size, but she might never be. We have no idea, but it's going to be fun watching her grow up.
Yeah, at 5 months, she's very energetic, right? I imagine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I don't think I could ever have a kid. I mean, I raised three kittens, but this time around, I just didn't see myself... Owning a kitten.
Just don't have
to. Or raising a kitten. Yeah, my brother was living with a kitten. It wasn't his, but it was a couple of years ago. His cat is about 5 years old now, or 6 years old, but she's very, very tiny. She looks like a kitten. But anyway, his roommate got a kitten, and the cat peed all over the place and was always torturing his cat, well, trying to play with her, but his cat wasn't interested, and it just seemed like a mess. And I don't think, I mean, kittens are fun to watch, but I don't think I could raise one.
I know the feeling. I had a puppy a long time ago and got him as a puppy. So he was a handful for the first couple of years. Because just as much energy and also destruction.
Oh yeah, maybe 2 years ago I lived with a dog. She was maybe 5 or 6, and but she seemed to have never matured. I don't know. That's kind of the way I see dogs now, is that they don't mature and mature very slowly. She seemed like a puppy, but she was too big to be running around the house like she was. One day she killed a cat, and then I wasn't very happy with her.
What is it, just to kind of just sum it up here, I mean, what is it about cats that makes them so great as pets in our eyes?
Well, for me, I think it might stem from this kind of like moving out of my mom's house and then into that other house, and the cats were very comforting to me, and I think that just kind of created this association of comfort, or maybe an obsession. Well, now it's an obsession because I'm a cat person. Cats stuff all over my apartment, ceramic cats and cat photos and stuff. But I also think they remind me of superheroes in a way. Like, at least they can jump really high and just do all these. Just, like, my cat will get scared out of nowhere sometimes and just do a flip and jump 4 feet into the air. But she also has a bed that's maybe 5 feet off the ground. And I just think it's amazing that to go to bed, she can just jump up there. And she can also claw the pole. And how it's just amazing how she can take care of herself. She can clean herself and use the bathroom, and I don't have to walk her. I just think they're amazing pets. But there's this obsession with them too, with the, well, obviously they own the internet for a while, and every person I know who has a cat, they don't just like their cat, they like cats, and they're obsessed with cats, and they want to talk about cats. I don't know what it is for other people. What is it for you?
I don't know. I know what you're saying, though. Physically, they're amazing to watch, but I didn't understand the internet's obsession with cats until I got one. And then within a week, my phone memory card is filled with just pictures of the cat. Like, now I understand.
Oh yeah, I take pictures of animals in general, but my phone mostly has cats in it. Any cat I see, I take a picture of it. But it's mostly pictures of my own cat who just walked into the room. But a lot of times she'll be sleeping next to me, but I'll just be sitting there scrolling through pictures in my phone of her. Yeah, like, what am I doing? She's right here next to me. I'm not sure what it is. I'm not sure if I understand the internet's obsession with cats, unless they're all cat owners. I think I was already into cats before the internet. It sounds like one of those "I liked it before it was cool" things. But I mean, but when cats were on the internet, I was cheering them on. I was like, yeah, everyone else likes cats. I don't feel so abnormal. And then I lived for a while before I moved here to Cincinnati. I lived maybe 4 years in Olympia, Washington, and it's a cat-centric place, and I think that's in part because it's a college town, and cats are easier to get into. When you're renting, it's easier to rent a place that allows cats than dogs. Maybe that's part of why. But there's just cats everywhere in Olympia, and I don't mean stray cats. I mean, if you meet someone, you go to their house, chances are they have a cat, or they love cats. But they don't have one. But they were everywhere.
I think cats are better. I'm not going to say cats are better than dogs, but if you're like a college student and you've got an apartment, a cat is better than a dog or another animal that needs more attention because, well, you've been in college a while and I've done my time as well. You're gone a lot of the time.
Yeah, I am. I spend most of my time on campus. And I think, well, I don't know how it works with walking dogs, but I noticed today several people walking their dogs up the street. I don't know how often dogs have to go to the, but I think I just wouldn't be home enough for it. And I don't really want to walk around and scoop up poop and all that stuff. And so it's just easier. Yeah, cats are just easier. So maybe that's part of why college kids like cats. I think of that. It's just easier.
Easier to deal with, you know?
Yeah.
And dogs need attention. Cats don't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most cats don't care, but I've had roommates that told me that when I leave, my cat meows until I come home. And then my brother was here. He lives in Olympia right now, but he stayed here last week for a few days. He came to visit, and he said that I went out to run some errands, and he said that my cat stood by the door and meowed until she got tired and fell asleep. And then yesterday I came in, and I noticed she was standing by the door, like blinking, as if she'd just woken up. She clearly just woken up. And yeah, I noticed that. I don't know. She's very attached, so she follows me around the apartment. Sometimes I trip over here. So I'm not sure what happened to her before I got her, but I think she kind of really needs. Well, I'm thinking back about you say cats pick their owner. I think she decided after she was living with me that I was her owner.
Yeah, maybe it was like a not a love at first sight kind of thing on her end, but now she's come to accept, okay, you're the one who feeds me. I'm cool with this. All right. I'll be cute, you keep the food coming, and we'll do this. That's our trade-off.
That's what I keep thinking. When I moved to Cincinnati in August for grad school, I encountered this thing that I'd never heard of before, which is a pet fee. Usually I paid a pet deposit, and then I get that deposit back, depending on certain circumstances. But here, there's a pet fee. It's $25 a month per animal. And it's like you don't get that back. You just pay it. And I was thinking, you're just so expensive, and all you have to do is be cute, and you get away with it.
Now you have leverage against the cat. Cat does something bad, you can be like, hey, you don't pay rent here. I pay your rent. Least you can do is not shred the pillow. Come on, man.
Yeah, that's why I have been saying that, because I was for a while she was peeing on the floor. I'm not sure why. It's because I moved her litter box. But she was peeing on the floor, and I was reminding her, Marissa, you don't pay rent here. I should start getting you to model. And so I started looking into modeling cats, but it looks like a pretty tough business to get into. But first of all, your cat has to be calm, and mine just isn't. I mean, she is, like, right now, she's just sitting here with me. But if I were to stand up, she would run across the room. Or if anyone came over, she would just be very cautious of them. So I don't think she wouldn't be able to sit still long enough to take pictures. It's hard to get pictures of her.
The things we think of when we're in grad school and we need money.
Yes, cat modeling. Yeah,
cat modeling.
It had never occurred to me before I moved here. I was like, she costs me $25 a month. Maybe she can pay for that herself.
We'll get you into the business somehow, kiddo, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, grad school life and everything. How are you liking grad school in general?
So I'm probably the only PhD student who's entering grad school without teaching experience. So that has been kind of overwhelming. But starting my second semester, since I've taught a class, I know a little bit of what I'm doing now. So prepping for classes and taking up so much time, so I have more time to dedicate to my schoolwork.
So you've just started teaching this semester or last semester?
Last semester, yeah.
Last semester. What was that like for you, the first time up?
Well, I imagined it. Because I remember there's like some master's students who are teaching for the first time. So they asked me if I was nervous because they were nervous. And I said, a little bit. But it's like having any other job, the way I saw it going into it is like I've had a lot of jobs where I just didn't know what I was doing. But eventually I learned my way into it and it felt okay. Like it felt natural. A lot of things come second nature. And so the first time up, I don't know. I didn't know what I was doing. Just kind of pretended like I did. It was a shit show. Oh, can I say that word?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Fuck yeah. Swear on this all you want. This is the internet.
Okay. Yeah, it was a bit of a shit show. And I was falling behind my other classes. It was a mess, but it was. I enjoyed it. I find it energizing to be in front of the class. Some of the grading gets overwhelming, but I don't know. I found that I'm easily manipulated, so kids manipulate me, and people say, "Tell me no, don't let them do that to you." So I'm finding just learning more about how 18-year-olds work, because currently I'm teaching first year composition. So that's I think that's another part of it, just learning how 18-year-old's work, and also just not spending so too much time prepping for class, because a lot of them are listening anyway, so I'm just going to have to repeat myself through email.
I would be shocked if you weren't nervous going into the first time. I can't name a single person I know who's a teacher or who has done teaching who wasn't at least somewhat terrified the first few weeks, and then slowly started finding a groove.
Yeah, I wasn't nervous what people expected me to be, because it's just like I had a call center job, and we're doing training that would say when you get your first call, you'll be so scared that you forget your name, and it was just like that. But then eventually I got into it, but I eventually got fired for that job for being too much of an introvert. And then I had another job, my last full-time job, was just caregiving for developmental adults. That was scary because, some of them were violent, and most of them were considered nonverbal. So it's just like, I don't know how to, just learning how to communicate with them. But after 6 months or so, a lot of things become second nature, and you just learn what you're doing. So that's just kind of what I applied to this. I just told myself this semester is going to be hard, and it's going to be, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, but eventually you'll learn what you're doing. So I think that kind of made me a little less nervous, but it showed on the students' evaluations that they knew I was nervous about things. They said I was unprepared, unorganized. I was like, yep, I was.
When you went into teaching for the first time, well, let me ask this question first. Well, a two-part question, kind of, sort of. One, I hate to throw it this way, but did you always want to be a teacher? Let me say this instead. After having done it, what did you think? Is it something that you want to continue doing? Did you get the bug, or is it like, okay, I'm done?
Oh, no. No, it was maybe after my first week, second, third, I don't know when. It was very soon that I realized that I want to continue doing it. I enjoy it. I mean, as with any job, or there's parts I don't like, there's parts I do like, but when I guess add up the pros and cons, which I haven't actually done, but I can just kind of sense that. But it's the most enjoyable job I've had, so I like it. I know I'm not doing the full adjunct thing. I almost said nightmare, but the way some people talk about it, I'm not doing that whole thing yet, so I know it gets rougher.
It does, but I'll tell you, just as a seasoned veteran now, it does get easier in some ways, because you eventually build up a storehouse of lesson plans and such that you don't even need notes anymore. You just go, oh yeah, that's what we're going to say on the syllabus. Got it. Done. Like computer files, almost. Okay, load this program.
Yeah, I definitely just using stuff from last semester, and just I'm changing a few things. For a couple, two major assignments, I'm changing what we're using because I have my own kind of theme for this course, and I want to try out some certain things. But other than that, I find myself using, like, and for one thing, in the mornings to take attendance, since I teach a Monday, Wednesday, Friday class. So I don't want to use up a lot of time taking attendance, so I use their informal writing assignments. So I'll ask them in the morning to write something, and that's the way they I'll take attendance. And so, yeah, I just find it a lot easier than last semester, and I imagine it'll just get easier going on, because I actually have a bunch of documents and folders that I came up with last semester that I'm just reusing again.
There you go. Once you start building the file system, then it starts clicking into place. You mentioned, you know, you worked a couple, you know, worked previous jobs, I think.
Yeah. That was about for a year and a half, maybe 2 years.
Did you find that some of the skills you learned working with that group, have you found ways to translate those skills into teaching?
I have. I mean, that's more of teaching life skills. I mean, the caregiving teaching is sort of teaching life skills, except teaching life skills such as, like, I don't know, making the bed or brushing, or someone brushing their own teeth. But say I only worked at a certain house for 3 days, that person would get into this routine with me, and then, but I would leave and then come back, and my coworkers hadn't been doing that with them because they wanted to sit around and watch TV or whatever. So then those skills were completely lost. I think that what I'm teaching with these students is, I think one thing that I like about it is that I'm with these students 3 days a week for the entire semester. So there's nothing that's going to get, you know, no one's going to come in the way and interrupt that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't have a coworker who's going to come in and be either lazy or just have another way of doing things that's going to interrupt that. So I feel like a lot more in control of the way students are learning, if they're choosing to learn, if they're choosing to pay attention. I think that's coming into it. That's part of what alleviated my anxiety. It was just kind of, it's weird to think of myself in authoritative role, but I had once been in that role. So the way I walked into caregiving, walked into these houses and had to go from being kind of passive and quiet and shy to being more just telling someone without revealing too much, get out of the trash can. Like sometimes they like to dig in the trash can. But doing that with like this certain insecurity, anxiety in my voice to it becoming natural, say, hey, get out of the trash can. That's not healthy. I knew that after a while that would become a part of me. Like I would develop this kind of persona that would, once I entered that house, that persona came on. And then once I entered the classroom, that would come on. So I knew that I would develop that after a while and I would get comfortable in the classroom. And yeah, so that's what helped. Is that what you ask? Sometimes I forget what the question is and I just start talking.
No, I think that answers it great, is that you develop a sense of confidence, you develop a sense of authority, and you carry that over into teaching. It's like, well, wait a minute. In this job, I had to become an authority figure and display that confidence. Here, I can borrow the thing because ultimately, I'm doing something similar. I am teaching someone a life skill.
Yeah. Do you think teaching composition is teaching life skills?
I do.
I was just thinking that, and I was like wondering, well, yeah, there was a point last semester. This semester, I don't think I'll have to, and I'll see. It's only been a week into the semester, 2 weeks actually. But my first semester, I had to teach them how to write emails. They just did not know how to write emails. So yeah, so that was one thing. Also, having them exchange contact information with each other was like another thing of me saying, as you advance your college careers and even in your outside career or whatever you choose to do, you're going to need to network more or just meet people, rely on other people, not always on the person in charge, not always on the teacher.
So would you say then that composition is a life skill?
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about that because I'm basically teaching critical thinking, critical writing. I didn't know coming into this that they didn't know how to, the students I have anyway, the students at my university anyway, didn't think analytically. They just saw the very surface of things. And so then I realized that's what I'm teaching right now. And so we're going through essays and like, I tried music videos, but I didn't like that very much. But then we used commercials, and next week I'm going to use a movie to just try to get them to think a lot deeper. And yes, that is a life skill. I had friends who were teaching the election, and I didn't have the whatever to teach the election. And I think they ended up quite anxious and unhappy with their students. Turning out, so looking at things such as, like I was looking at the debates and looking at, I remember there was a certain time where the Social Security question or the Medicare question came up, and Hillary Clinton was being very specific, but Donald Trump just kept saying disaster. He just kept using the word disaster to describe Obamacare, but it wasn't specific at all. And so I was looking at that and thinking how people who don't think critically don't really, they don't probably don't really see the difference between Clinton saying something very, very specific about this and her knowledge, and then someone else just saying disaster, but not describing how it's a disaster. So I didn't talk to my students about the election all that much, but in their papers, I did have them, if they had words in there that they were repeating over and over, like disaster, like why is disaster? Like, what does that mean? And so having them look at that, so that I think when they go into things like to vote or to even buy a car or anything, they'll be able to like analyze what someone's saying, or even just to see that someone is not being specific enough with them, and then to wonder why.
It's that element of rhetoric. You know, who is your audience? How do you phrase something in order to get the audience on your side in whatever it may be? I think you're right, too, about you mentioned essentially teaching students how to write emails. I think that's there's value in that. I'm not dumping on students, and I'm not dumping on young people, but students sometimes, and young people don't realize, because we're so engrossed in casual language and texting and status updates and Twitter, that we forget, hey, wait a minute, my boss may not respond to this email requesting time off the same way I would ask a friend to, hey, can we cancel our movie day today?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, too, is that these kids, unlike me, they just grew up like just on the internet, on smartphones. I think, and like if you look at YouTube comments, they're just so disgusting. Like people just saying nasty things to each other, but they're never seeing each other's face. I think sometimes that when they're emailing me, they sometimes forget there's a person on the other side. So they say things to me in email that they wouldn't say in person. Yeah.
I tell students first day, it's like, when you write an email, it doesn't just go off into the ether. Somebody reads your thought. And so you have to now suddenly consider that. So maybe composition is a life skill.
It is, I think so, yeah. And also getting just, have you ever had a student just send you an attachment with no words on it?
Yes.
Yeah, I just couldn't take that. It was weird. And so I said, okay, we got to learn how to write emails, a greeting, and then say something in the body, even if you're giving me an attachment. So I'll just get an attachment with their paper and no message. I'm like, are you really in that much of a hurry?
Can you give me a few seconds to know what this attachment is? Because I have a lot of students and I have a lot of attachments coming. Just clarify real quick.
Yeah, but just also doing research projects, choosing a topic that they like, that they're interested in, and then digging deeper into that in order to learn more, either learn more about that or to share it with someone, or even just to find out why they're interested in that topic, or if they really are. Because, I don't know, sometimes I'm skeptical about why students have chosen certain majors.
Honestly, I'm glad to hear you say you like teaching, because I think it's a great profession. I think there's a lot to be said for it. So, obviously, you've had, you were not always a teacher and everything. I'm just going to dip way back for a moment here. You were born in Texas?
No, I grew up in Texas. I was born just outside of D.C., but I left there when I was 3 because I was allergic to everything. I was on all kinds of, like, breathing machines and stuff. So just allergies, and my mom's family lived in Texas, so we moved to Texas. I moved there when I was 3, though, and I left when I was 20, so I grew up there.
Do you still hold Texas? Do you have a fondness for it, or are you a person who says, I'm never going back?
No, I'm not going back to Texas. No, I have no fondness for Texas whatsoever. I was much more fascinated by, because I left Texas when I was 20, 21, and I moved just outside of Seattle, and then eventually, after a few years, made my way to Olympia to go to my undergrad there for financial reasons. Initially very fond of Olympia. There was this little gazebo, and I grew up as a fan of Gilmore Girls. I was like, this is like Stars Hollow. This is amazing. But then eventually, it's a small city, and so I got tired of being such a small place. But I'm still like very fascinated by it.
And now you're in Ohio.
Yeah. Oh, I think I'm still very fond of the Pacific Northwest. There was something about the weather there that was very, I don't, like, in Texas it was just so hot all the time. But there's something about the weather in Pacific Northwest that made me feel like I was part of like a special community. Like, what, so for instance, when I'm here and it's drizzling and I'm walking with someone and they say, get your umbrella out. It's like, it's just drizzle. And then I just kind of miss Pacific Northwest, where that near constant drizzling, it's just not really a big deal. I don't know. There's something about the weather there that made me feel like I was part of a special community and that I was experiencing something very unique and new to me. And I think it was, it's just like everything, so much is planned around the weather, or so much like it's just learning about learning to ignore or I don't know, adapt to the weather in a way that I wasn't used to in Texas. And here in Cincinnati, I don't, it's, the weather's predictable, but it's, I don't know. I'm still getting to learn to know this place.
I think you answered my next question, which was just that, you know, okay, D.C. to Texas to the Pacific Northwest to Ohio, bouncing all around the country. Is there any place that so far that you've encountered that you really feel almost like calling home in a way that you think of as a home?
No. not at all. I don't feel at home anywhere. But I guess I have the most fondness for the Pacific Northwest because I spent 9 years there, and that's when I was just like this emerging adulthood kind of phase. So from going from 21 to 30, I turned 30 there and then moved here. So I feel like that's where I grew up. But I don't know. Wait, what does it mean when people say where you grew up? Because I mean, I literally spent my childhood to coming of age in Texas, but I feel like I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, even though I was there for 9 years, only 9 years. So I fondness for that area. I was thinking of AWP and how it might be in Portland a couple years from now or something. Yeah, so I think most of my friends are there. So I guess if I had to choose a place, it was like, you have to pick a home, I would choose the Pacific Northwest.
Interesting to say, you know, I'd never thought about it until you just mentioned it. What does it mean to grow up? Because I consider upstate New York my home, but I really grew up in Mississippi by that definition then when I was 30. Like, that's where I grew up. Everything just hit at once. But I'm going to have to really... Thanks, Bernard. You're going to make me reflect on my life now over the weekend.
I sit around doing that a lot. Especially with going on right now.
Us writers, we do that.
Yeah. So how old were you? You said you grew up in Mississippi?
I grew up in upstate New York, physically. But I left there when I was 29 to go to grad school. And it was in Mississippi for 3 years, and that's where I found myself. That's where I grew up, essentially.
Oh, that's where you became a writer. I started writing in 2012. Yeah, and I was in Washington when I became a writer and became, I don't want to say profession, that writer is how I identify myself. So I think that might be why I have such a fondness for that area.
Had you done much with writing before that? Like, was your undergrad English before that, or did you do stories as a kid or anything like that?
Oh, when I was a kid, I wrote with my mom's electric typewriter. I was trying to write like a kid's version of Star Wars, and it was called The Womp. And then there was this cartoon that I liked, and they had the same word, womp. I don't know where I got this word from, but it was like, you know, Star Trek, they have, Star Wars. Sorry, I'm not science fiction anymore. But Star Wars, what is that? The Force? So it was similar to that. But on this cartoon, it was like the Womp was like this kids, the elementary school kids. It was their way of annoying adults because they weren't allowed to use cuss words. So they invented their own, which was Womp. And they were just irritating the elementary school faculty by using this word that wasn't a cuss word. It was just... It's so funny, but I remember just thinking, that's really smart. I quit. Like, all I'm doing is copying. I was maybe 8, 9 years old. And then I kept journals around for a while, but they always just felt so dirty, like having, like, porn or something. It's just, like, something I didn't want anyone to find, and I was always afraid of someone finding it, so I would... When I moved into that house with all the animals, I remember... since I was living with a bunch of people, I remember everyone was gone or asleep, and I went to the kitchen and took all my journals and or diaries, or I don't know the difference, I really care, and I ran water over them, and just tore the pages and made sure they were just complete mush. And then, I mean, because the writing was mush. And so, and then I just threw them away. And I think I was 18 then. I didn't write again until I was an undergraduate. And I went to college late. I kept going and dropping out. So I didn't write again until I was 25, I think. 26.
Well, thankfully you've come back to it, though. Was there anything that made you just start it up again? Was it a teacher? Was it a class? Was it just, you know what? What the hell? Let's write something.
It was a class. When I finally got serious about school, I was a film student. I was just not making film because electronics freaked me out. I just get flustered around them. They confuse me. So it was more just like studying film theory and watching a lot of classic films. But then I got to this class that was studying. We were studying the adaptation, so from the literary adaptation from the novel to the book to film. It was a two-quarter class. The second part of the class, we had to actually write a short story, and then write a screenplay based off of it. So that replaced our like academic papers. In the first quarter, we wrote academic papers. The second quarter, we actually wrote, and the teacher. She's a wonderful teacher, but she, when I was writing the screenplay based off the short story I wrote, she kept telling me, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't do that, because I kept trying to have the characters think about things. And I was like, okay, well, I'm tired of not being able to do that. So then I just switched to creative writing and literature. And I, for some reason, I lost interest in film completely, not completely, but for the most part, I lost interest in film. And just started reading and writing a lot. And that's when it started. That was about 2012. I always remember that because it was the start of a year of January and the start of like something new in my life.
It's shocking how similar our stories line up then. Because I started out in film and filmmaking, then started going to film analysis, and then got into a, well, short, long story short, I got into a fight with the film department and dropped out and went to English. And never looked back.
Was that graduate school?
No, that was undergrad. That was my junior year. Basically, we watched E.T. They tried to psychoanalyze it. I asked, why can't we just accept this as a children's film and made money? And they wanted to kill me.
Yeah, wasn't that movie heavily about advertisement?
It is. There's a lot going on in that film, but I just... And while I can see the Freudian and psychosexual aspects of the film, I'm just like, I want to make goofy blockbuster films and silly films. And they're like, no, you've got to make serious art. And I'm like, that's it, I'm out.
Well, it's good that you made the decision to follow something that's more important to you.
You follow your passion in the end. But it is great that you returned to writing, Bernard, because you had a chapbook come out not too long ago.
Yeah, with Yellow Chair Press, yeah. It's called Fly Back at Me. It's a collection of interlinked flash fiction stories. So there's 15 of the stories, and they're told from the point of view of a one child. So it's based off my childhood. I don't know if I'll say it's loosely based or what, but it's based off my childhood.
Definitely will encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of that if they have not already. But, Bernard, before we let you go, obviously, you're busy right now with classes and getting into teaching and everything. Are you working on anything, though? Anything upcoming, coming out soon, or you just got in the works right now?
I don't know. I just had a couple of essays come out. There's an essay with New Delta Review and an essay with Lunch Ticket. And I think there's a story coming out with Crab Book Review in their next issue. And that story is part of my It was my MFA thesis, but now it's just my full-length manuscript, which is a novel and stories that takes place in Olympia, because I was fascinated by that place. And so I guess that one, that manuscript is just, someone's reading it right now, mm-hmm. while I continue to work on this essay collection about like coming of age in this traditional sense, and kind of blending that with coming of age through illness, because I've been sick for the past 2 years. So just kind of looking at those two things. So yeah, working on a collection, and some of those essays have been published in my first chapbook with Paper Knowledge Press, and then I'm starting a novel.
So lots to look forward to, perhaps coming out in the next year or two. We shall We shall definitely keep our ears and eyes open, Bernard. Before we let you go, where can the folks find you online? They want to check you out a little bit. Of course, naturally, you're on Facebook. Are you on Twitter?
I'm not on Twitter. Twitter confuses me. I'm on Facebook, though, and I had a website, but then for certain reasons, I'm just too lazy to work on websites, so I'm having someone work on it for me, and so it won't be up until mid-February.
Do let us know when it drops. We'll post a link for it and everything so people can check you out. Bernard, it is a pleasure having you on this program. Thanks, man, for coming on and being with us today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care of yourself and enjoy kitty snuggles. They are the greatest.
Oh, you too. Enjoy your new cat.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.